Okay, thank you very much for organizing this, for having me. I'm truly honored and flattered that you're paying so much attention to this work, and all the more kind of here because I've learned a bit about the interdisciplinary project that you have. And if I only had it known before, maybe it could have been one of my episodes that I describe in the book. But I'm so pleased that you are trying to use the approach in your own research, and I'm so much looking forward to learning about how you think along these topics. So what I'm going to do is to present a bit the framework of this research and trying to explain why me or somebody else would need this different approach to philosophy of science and technology. So maybe let me begin briefly with why I needed this philosophy of technoscience. And this is a kind of reflection of where I come from and how I've developed over the years. I've been really trained in this mainstream Anglo-American philosophy of science, way of doing philosophy. And I had no exposure whatsoever to philosophy of technology question until early in my postdoc times, where I started collaborating with some people in Padua, and they were trying to set up an excellent center on nanotechnology from different perspectives. And this is where I first started thinking about technology in different ways, in the plural. But still, whenever I was trying to tell my colleagues in philosophy of science that I had this interest, there was a lot of either resistance or dismissal. So it was very, very hard to start a conversation. And roughly at the same time, I was studying the philosophy of information, which for me was about information from a logical perspective, an epistemic perspective. But then I was invited to contribute a paper on Luciano Floridi's philosophy of technology. And that was like an eye-opener that his approach to information was a way of looking at technology in a different way. And so kind of this early exposure to philosophy of technology question plus philosophy of information in this way started kind of having some effect on my brain. And so what I did was effectively retraining myself in these two fields, philosophy of technology and philosophy of information, and starting asking questions about philosophy of science in a different way. So really kind of rewind the classic field sci question and see what may happen to these questions if we adopt this type of approach. And basically what you see in the book is somehow what I came up with in this exercise. But if you allow me kind of to go again a step back in the process that I took, nobody's going to deny that technology plays a role in science, especially nowadays. Just think of the Large Hadron Collider, massive telescope to observe exoplanets and blah, blah, blah. But I thought that what was at stake was not just that now we have this massive technological infrastructure. I'm not a fine historian myself, but I mean, technology has been there in science and in everyday life since ever. So I thought maybe there is something else that we need to say, not just that this is a problem that we have to address now, but we may want to ask the question differently because technology has been there and it has been neglected in the way we look at science, at least in this mainstream Anglo-American tradition. But in fact, what was there was this division between science on the one hand, technology on the other. And this also has deep roots in Greek thinking. That's why we have the term episteme and techne, that they are really separated and even in a hierarchical order. First science and then technology, if you have some memories of Greek thinking. And this gradually crystallized also in a division of labor between philosophy of science on the one hand and philosophy of technology on the other hand. And this is the situation that is pretty much in place still nowadays. But I mean, just kind of realizing how much technology and instruments are part and parcel of the scientific process, I gradually actually start asking the question, how is knowledge generated in this techno-scientific context? If we kind of move away from the idea that technology is this abstract intellectual thing, but it really depends on how we do things in practice, and in this practice, instruments play a large role, then maybe there is something else that we have to say. And this is how I started considering the question of the role of instruments in this process of knowledge generation. So this is kind of the broad framework. The thing that I would like to do now is to give you some more details about this divide between philosophy of science and philosophy of technology, because it is also pretty difficult to see it unless you are from within the profession. And so the first thing that you may want to notice is that there are really parallel contexts and debates. We have very distinct institutional contexts. If you look at learned societies, conferences, job openings, it really looks like these are different, distinct communities. And it's not accident that we have a major philosophy of science conference, whether it is the European one or the one in the US. And then there is the philosophy of technology conference. And it's not the same people that go to these two conferences. But we also have something pretty big at the level of academic outputs. I went through major publications in either field and noticed how little cross-reference there is between these two fields. So if you take a major author such as Nancy Cartwright in philosophy of science, she's mentioned probably a couple of times in major handbooks and major contributions in philosophy of technology. Likewise, if you take a major thinker in philosophy of technologies, such as Don Heide, the same happens in philosophy of science. And still, their contributions, for instance, about questions on scientific realism, are really prominent in either field. But clearly, we do not pay attention to the other context. And so there is very little mutual recognition in terms of authors and in terms of main teams. And this is perpetuates in the way we teach these subjects. Now, if you look at more philosophically what happens in these fields, it looks like there are also very distinct objects of investigation. I rely here on the reconstruction of Mike Bohn, who is a philosopher of science in practice based in the Netherlands, and one of the rare cases that she really tried to bridge the two fields. But so the way she puts it is that on the one hand, we really look at different types of knowledge, science aiming at truth, technology looking more at usefulness for practical purposes. Clearly, there is a lot of hierarchy in this thinking because, as I said before, first science and then technology. And this is really very much in line with the Greek way of understanding episteme and techne. But also there are different relations to reality. In science we discover, and in technology we create artifacts. And also different outputs. Science comes up with the theories, technology comes up with artifacts. So, you know, this kind of separation is going on and on. The objects of science are unchanging objects because they are natural objects. But in technology, we created these objects, and so they are mutable. I mean, how can we question this division? I mean, very much so. And also the question of instrumentality. True science is supposed to be necessary for technological innovation. But we rarely think also of how much technology is instrumental to science, and so how this may change the way in which we look at, the way in which we produce knowledge. Now, what I've done in the book is, first of all, to reconstruct this divide, and it is a very big divide, but at the same time, we have to acknowledge that there have been attempts to bridge the gap. On the one hand, in the past 10-15 years, the philosophy of science in practice has really tried to broaden up the Anglo-American typical approach to philosophy of science by looking at the practice. And so if you look at the practice, then it is much easier to include considerations about instruments and technology. So the seeds are there, but the transition is not fully done yet. But at the same time, what I think is very interesting to note is that you don't have to go very far back in time, but the French epistemology is a deeply neglected tradition, neglected by Anglo-American traditions, in which the gap did not exist at all. I mean, just read Bachelard, and it is all about science and technology together and this intertwinement. But we forgot, we never bothered learning a bit of basic French to read it. It has been translated late, and it has been not read, and so off you go. You know, we had already the elements, and we haven't used them, and now we have to reinvent the wheel, or perhaps it is an opportunity also to be more to diversify more our training and our reading interests. So, who would need this reconstruction? I think really scholars in either field, because they are looking for clues about the divide. And while I'm presenting this the book to different types of audience, I noticed that especially more junior generation really have an interest in this intertwinement of science and technology more than people that have been trained really in this division. And so if you are interested in the questions and this intersection, I think it is also important to understand that it is not mainstream yet to have this view of the connection between the two topics. You maybe really have a struggle still in having to do with two different communities. And this is not to blame one or to the other, but I think it is important to have some reflection of what kind of communities you may want to interact with. So that's also why I did this kind of reconstruction. But also in trying to teach these topics, this is really an opportunity, because if we teach about the divide, then we can also teach how we can somehow go and converge a bit on the questions. And so hopefully this helps teaching philosophy of science and technology in a different way. What has helped me a lot is to really shift focus from the outputs of science, explanation, the model, the theory, to the practice, so how we do things. But what was very telling in the process of looking at the practice is that there isn't just one way to look at practice. And there have been at least three practice turns that I could recognize in the literature. The one that is perhaps better known is the one in STS that we identify with the work of Latour, for instance, laboratory studies, the idea of science as practice, and also looking at contemporary practice that matter, and so the need of an anthropology or this kind of ethnographic approach to these practices. In philosophy of science, we also had some kind of practice turn related to what is called the new experimentalism, where people looked at experiments and also at their materiality that did matter. But ultimately, the reason why they were looking at these practices was to provide different types of arguments for scientific realism. And so to say it's not just the theory that matters, and from the theory that you derive what is real and what is not, you have to understand how the material aspects of an experiment contribute to this. But the question was still there. I mean, we want to be scientific realists. And interestingly enough, philosophy of technology also had their own its own practice turn, looking at the relevance of the design process, and it's not just the nature of a technical object that matters, but it's also about the practice of engineering, and so including a slightly different type of dimension, that is not just the creation of an artifact, but also engineering as a field needs to have some attention, and the practice perspective really helps in this. Now, easier said than done, what does it mean to look at practices and to study practices? The The best tool that I found is really the work of Hasok Chang, who is a philosopher and historian of science, and probably the person who has, the scholar who has tried to give a methodology for studying practices. And I'm here giving a list, which is not probably very readable, but let me try to do something else, if I can get rid of my picture over there, but no, I can't, doesn't matter. And he gives a list of things you may want to pay attention to. For instance, the activity, what is being done in the practice in question, but also the aims. So what is the purpose of the research, but also the agent, who is actually doing the activity? What kind of agent is this? What kind of expertise do they have? What kind of role do they have in the dynamic of the system? But also what kind of capabilities do they have? What are these people capable, able to do? And so in a number of these questions, then you can see that you can sneak in considerations about social environment, scientific environment, the instruments, very profound considerations about metaphysical presuppositions. So there is quite a lot. And for me, the point is not that every single study in philosophy of science in practice or history in philosophy of science, depending on how you want to pitch it, has to answer all these questions. For me, the point is that this is some guide to help you decide what you want to give emphasis to or priority to. But also, these types of questions really cut across conceptual, normative, historical, and sociopolitical considerations. And so for me, shifting this focus from the outputs to the practice is also a way of liberating philosophy of science from the idea that it has to be very sharp, theoretical, conceptual. Not necessarily. I mean, there are very interesting considerations that come from more from an STS side, and you may want to complement them with more theoretically oriented discussions typical of philosophy of science. And so I want to use this as a very flexible guide to make decisions for myself and for whoever wants to be in this practice approach to say, I mean, how we use this, okay? So, any one of us may benefit from using this practice approach as long as we do not crystallize it again into some kind of rigid checklist or in a kind of a rigid protocol of how things have to be done. Okay, and so with this background, I was trying to ask again, you know, what is knowledge then? What is knowledge but then? But then while formulating my question, there was another way of formulating it, and that was, who produces knowledge? Clearly, human beings, but also prominently, the instruments, you see? So this is how I tried myself to look at practices in a different way, with in the back of my mind, I want to understand how we produce this knowledge. Not what is a theory, but how do we come to know whatever we say we know? And even there, I mean, in trying to understand that the role of instruments is not that there is just one received view that I had to deal with. In mainstream philosophy of science, that was easy. Basically, there was no discussion on instruments. It's all about theory and propositional content. The little bit that is there is about new experimentalism. And even there, it's not so prominently about what the instruments do. In philosophy of technology, there is this prominent view that instruments mediate or are bearers of knowledge. And then STS has more this idea of technocratic regimes that contribute to the solidification of knowledge, not so much how we produce knowledge. So every time it looks like I was at a crossroad. Either I look at people, or I look at the conceptual space, or I look at the artifacts. But you know, there was no way that just using what existed, I could answer the question I was interested in, which was really about the intertwinement. Okay, and what I tried to do then was to give a very different reconstruction of what knowledge is. And I think, Alex, you're going to talk about this later, so maybe I will skip this just to give you a very quick idea and go further. So the way I try to characterize knowledge is as a product of technoscientific activities carried out by epistemic agents, often expressed in propositional form in natural language, encapsulated in material objects, and situated with respect to a number of social, cultural, material aspects. I did not try the usual philosophy strategy, knowledge is definition, or something is knowledge if and only if, set of conditions, not at all. I was really trying to give a characterization in which I could talk about a relation, distribution, embodiment, materiality, and also vernacularity, which still is important because we express knowledge in propositional forms. But I did not want to kind of just stick to one or the other. I wanted to be able, if anything, to understand what the relations between these things are. And whether you emphasize one or the other, again, it depends on how you are looking at the practice. So when I tried to look at knowledge in this different way, then I could reformulate my question, because I was interested in how humans and instruments are kind of partners in crime in this production. But it is only by having a much broader characterization of knowledge that I could set up the question differently, because otherwise I was stuck in the kind of three received views that I mentioned before. Okay, so who would need this characterization of knowledge? Clearly analytic philosophers, and I want to make a joke in there, because hopefully they will see that there is more than justified true belief that we can say about knowledge. And it doesn't mean that it is not true that we justify our beliefs, but it means that, I mean, there is so much else that knowledge is that you can't just define it in this way and then forget everything else. But also, I think if you look at the spectrum of how you may be interested in science and or technology, and that's why technoscience has a dash, because you can unite or divide as you seem to fit, then you can give focus to your interest. And you tell me whether it is more embodiment that plays a role, or more materiality, or more the expression and the vernacularity of knowledge, okay? But again, you may still ask, I mean, why do I bother so much with instruments? And the reason is that I had this very strong intuition, and I was trying to find arguments to support this intuition, that instruments do more than just mediating between us and the world, which would be really a mainstream view in philosophy of technology and especially post-phenomenology. Also, they do more than just augmenting our capacities to see the smaller or the bigger, which would be the super naive view that many philosophers of science would have without engaging 1 minute with philosophy of technology, but also enhance the ability to analyze more data, which is kind of what many people have been after now that it's all data science, data-driven, big data, blah, 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 and say, ah, yes, of course, we have the computer, so we can compute more. Well, I mean, more than that. So I was trying to provide arguments that would explain why we need to take really interest in this question in a very specific way. And the specific angle that I was trying to carve out in this literature was the proper epistemic role. Not just the instrumental, but epistemic has an important role, because we tend to think that it is just us humans that have this epistemic role, because we are the ones that with our brain capacities, we create the theories of give the explanation. And this is where comes really the big proposal of this piece of work, and that it is encapsulated in the concept of poiesis. And it is a way of expressing the fact that we co-produce knowledge. So here I'm emphasizing human and artificial agents. So I want to give agency also to instruments, and I will say a bit more about that in a moment, but also I picked poiesis as a specific concept because it helps me spell out the way in which knowledge is produced, which is something that will really irritate mainstream philosophers of science, because we don't produce knowledge. Knowledge is some intellectual thing, okay? If we produce things, it's an artifact, perhaps, but not a concept, say. And this is where I want to provoke a bit, that there is something to be said. But also it may be worrying to those who are hardcore realists, because if you are a realist and the world is out there, you know, what it is that you produce, you know, at best you discover these things. And so there is a lot of background for why I went for the concept of poiesis. And it is a concept that has a huge legacy as well. From Greek thinking, poiesis is about producing artifacts. It's about techne, not about episteme. And this is really the root cause of this alleged superiority of episteme over techne. So I am very conscious that clearly I'm not just taking the concept in its original meaning. But also from contemporary philosophy of information, poiesis has been used to explain the way in which moral agents produce, in part at least, the situation they are in. And here again, the critical target is a certain analytic approach into ethics, where we ask whether it is better to kill one people or 10 people if the trolley is going one direction or another. And nobody ever bothered asking, how did you get there on that trolley? And philosophers of technology in value-sensitive design rebutted, but who was this engineer designing the tracks in this way, okay? So there poiesis helps, because you can really question the situation and not just a focus of, is it better to kill one or 10? Well, you know, maybe the problem is a few steps back, you see. So, what is the semantic space of poiesis that I'm trying to carve out here? On the one hand, I want to be able to say that human epistemic agents have a poietic character, because clearly we produce artifacts, fair enough. This is a topos of Greek philosophy, not my main interest, but clearly it is there. We build this table, we build a computer, we build plenty of things, and this is clearly one way in which we cash out the concept of poiesis. But also I want to be able to say that poiesis has to do with the production of knowledge, because I am trying to expand the notion of homo poieticus in the sense of moral agent that comes from the philosophy of information to include techno-scientists and also us philosophers. And I rely also on the philosophy of Deleuze and Guattari here in trying to explain how we produce knowledge. So it's not just the philosophy of information, but also kind of to regain a broader scope and have some good old continental philosophy on board. At the same time, I want to be able that artificial agents also have poietic character, because they have the power to interact and modify the environment. This is clearly the case for digital technologies, and this is where a lot of the attention goes. But also, I want to be able that there is a sense in which also old-fashioned analog technologies have this power that comes in degrees. And this is where I'm really recovering, again, a French epistemology, and especially the philosophy of Gilbert Simondon, to be able to calibrate and modulate the sense in which artificial epistemic agency have some degrees of autonomy, some degree of agency. And the point is exactly to be able to say how much of this they have and how our agency and autonomy interact with there. And so the partnership of human and artificial epistemic agents is really important. But for me, identify that there is a partnership in the production of knowledge also comes with important responsibilities that are both epistemic and moral. So why does this matter? Clearly, I take from extreme kind of in philosophy of science in practice and STS that knowledge production is distributed. And so we both produce this knowledge. And clearly this is an epistemic point, because I want to be able to say that forget it is just us. There is a lot that the instruments do for and with us, and we have to be able to acknowledge this point. This is an epistemic point, okay? But there is also a normative point, because it doesn't mean that we therefore have less responsibilities, you know, because we just defer. It wasn't me, it was the algorithm. If anything, the opposite is the case. We have much more responsibility, because we can decide whether or not to even design and build instruments to produce such knowledge. We design and make decisions about how much autonomy and agency we give to algorithms, for instance, now that it is kind of the big question in digital technologies, etc. So come on, it's really a way of saying it is within our power to make these decisions, and so we really have to take the responsibility on our shoulder. So this is where the normative point comes across. And so in a sense, it's a way of saying epistemology and ethics must go hand in hand. We have to stop thinking that if I'm a philosopher of science, I can just go without bothering with ethics, because it is the job of my colleagues in the other part of the building. It's really kind of the same conversation that we are having, and the two things are really connected. So again, who is needing this? I hope I'm able to give an idea of where we have to go somehow. And I see this philosophy of technoscience as the space where philosophy of science, philosophy of technology, science and technology studies, ethics and political philosophy somehow meet, because I see it as an intellectual and academic space where we may want to retain some of the specificities of our respective fields, and yet be able to talk to each other and understand why certain arguments that say are more epistemic in character have an impact on the ethics, or the other way around, and so to collaborate more. And the way I've always looked at it is that if I achieve anything with this book is that it starts something out. And that's why I was so curious to, and I am very curious to see what you make out of it in the project that you are running, and how you can think about these things. Because I don't think I'm owning in any way the field. If anything, I want to be able to give tools to others to work, and also to kind of overcome some of my struggles with this division, and hopefully you can just go to the next step and do the cool, interesting thing, and just be aware that there have been these struggles that some for you has tried somehow to bridge and resolve. And I made it in 32 minutes. Was it good? Thank you.
I agree that there is this cooperation between epistemic agents, artificial epistemic agents, and human epistemic agents. The question is, why go for the term agents with really analog instruments, if you could also maybe spell out that they still have a fundamental role? Why does it need to be a productive role?
What would be the alternative term that comes to your mind, Maud?
Instrumental still, that at least they are still used, and if you get more learning, that then you talk really about agents, but maybe for, yeah.
It's fine, I don't have an objection that you keep calling them instruments or technologies. I have been pretty liberal in the terminology that I used in the book, for one thing, but clearly when I try to explain this idea of the co-production, the going for agent allows me to, first of all, to put them on the same footing as a starting point, and also to emphasize that the instruments do something, and not just giving them instrumental role, as if it is just for us to use them, that then they have a role. And then, of course, the difficulty is to modulate how much of this agency they have, but also what is important to note is that I am working with a very minimal definition of agency, one that does not presuppose, for instance, consciousness, and so a number of instruments may satisfy these minimal conditions of agency, and for me it is good enough because then I can do the rest of the work later on. But clearly, and especially if you write for scientists, you stick to instruments. I think it's really a philosophical point to call them agents in this context.
Super interesting. Thank you. Any other questions? But at least we have all read the book, and I think we have had some questions, mostly, I think, related to the term agent, poiesis, and knowledge as well. We have quite some. I think what is interesting, what for us came up again and again, is what is this material part of knowledge? How would you frame?
So the materiality clearly has to do with the materiality of the instruments. That is one part of the materiality. But I also want to give some materiality to knowledge itself, which is not an easy claim to make, because we tend to associate knowledge with something highly intellectual. But I want to be able to say that it has some materiality in various ways. One way is how we express this knowledge. We write it in papers. Sometimes it is printed out in books, and the books, the material printed one, also has a materiality, but also a PDF as a form of materiality. And then you think, why does this matter? Well, maybe it does not matter that much for scientific knowledge per se, but if you talk to people working in pedagogy, they will tell you that it does matter whether you learn writing by hand, whether you learn typing, whether you read on paper or on screen. This has an effect on how you absorb kind of the material. So knowledge also has this kind of materiality, because we interact with part of the way it is expressed. But also it has a materiality in the sense that it is a semantic artifact. This is one idea that I also take from the philosophy of information. And I like the idea of giving it the status of some artifact, even if it is not the artifact like this pen or this glass, because it really shows that it takes a lot of effort on our side to get to this thing that then we call knowledge, a new concept, etc. And so the objection that classic philosophers of science and epistemologists may have is really to have just this idea of the intellectual part of knowledge. It falls from the sky, theories fall from the sky. I mean, we never know where these physics theories come from. We just discuss what their formal features are and what it means to have the next physics framework that is broader than encapsulate the previous one. But I mean, they relegated this idea of coming up with what the theory is, say, to sociology of science and only to the sociological aspect. But I want to be able to say that epistemology, proper epistemology and philosophy of science, has to be able to say something about that. And so I'm playing here with the concept of semantic artifact also for this reason. So there are different aspects to knowledge being material at stake, and these are some of them.
Maybe a follow-up question on that. I think people buy it really easily that knowledge has material when we think about books or, as you said, PDFs, and where the knowledge is encapsulated. But then with the semantic artifacts, why is it for you materiality and then not a form of embodiment? So what is the exact difference between embodiment and materiality?
Where do you see the embodiment in there?
I think because the semantic artifact is, I mean, we cannot touch it, right? So the materiality is missing, but it's still somehow embodied in a way in the artifact. that's where I see the more of embodiment than materiality. But maybe I have a very literal understanding of materiality.
But that's fine by me. You see, I don't think that the way I'm characterizing these things should be the only one.
Yeah.
So I'm asking back where you see the embodiment, because maybe what you have in mind are other aspects of a practice that you are dealing with, where this form of embodiment kind of is more telling that my characterization in terms of the materiality. Mm. But I guess another reason why I'm stressing materiality is because of the status of whatever is digital. And those who would be reluctant in giving materiality to the digital sphere, I disagree. You know, it is as real as the offline world. But I mean, materiality doesn't have to come just in the status of touching this piece of wood and say it is hard, you see. And maybe it is. It has materiality more for the effects it has, more than its nature. Fair enough. But a concept is a kind of artifact, not a material artifact, a semantic one. And so you can attach meaning to it, and you can disagree on this meaning. That's why it is a semantic, because you can also discuss about these semantic aspects. But it has an aspect of artifactuality, because it's not just falling from the sky.
I wanted to ask you about your use and construction of poiesis as kind of the word to describe the co-production of knowledge by human artificial or human epistemic agents and technology. And I want to come from a point that I had encountered this word once before reading your book, but couched in the phrase autopoiesis, used to describe the construction of the self in memories by people, and often held as a distinguishing factor between animal memory and human memory. And I want to know if you were curious with that concept, and if you are, I had already encountered that concept, and I'm curious if you had, how it related to your idea of poiesis, and if this is new, how you feel it relates to the construction of poiesis you've made.
You're teaching me something there, Alex, because I did a long search whether the concept of poiesis was used elsewhere, and I didn't find much. There was just another use that was totally out of context, was more in the political sphere, and it was not really related to the techno-scientific knowledge. And so I don't think I even included that in the discussion of poiesis. So for me, the two big legacies were a kind of the Greek thinking about poiesis and the philosophy of information in terms of starting this idea of the poietic, the homo poieticus, etc. So I would be very curious to learn where you encountered the concept and to learn about it, because maybe there is something that escaped me, and that's perfectly fine. It's not that this is an omniscient kind of piece of work, but from what you say, it seems that it is aligned. So maybe, I don't know whether you're going to talk about this later, or...
I will say that the initial goal of my talk was to build toward a construction of autopoiesis, and I don't think I got there, but hopefully we can get there in some of the conversation afterwards.
Because I would be very curious to see where you encounter the concept, what kind of text and scholarship this is in engaging with. And otherwise, it's quite funny that none of the the searches via Google and elsewhere that I tried came up with this hit on on the records.
I think we'll have a great chance to talk more about it, but I'll say Tolving is the, I think, primary scholar associated with the idea of autopoiesis, as well as Michael Corballis and Thomas Sudendorf.
Okay, well, I'm happy to discuss this later, because it seems very, very relevant.
Okay, so first, thank you for the talk. It was really, really nice. I would like to come back to the materiality again, because...
It's a popular topic. Yes.
Because in the book, you have this chapter on models, and models being also physical entities and material and something we can tinker and manipulate and so on. And while I was reading this part, we were also having these nice discussions in our physics group on how ChatGPT or natural language models may or may not be able to create these models or to be powerful enough to develop something like the models we build for reality. And to me, I somehow thought that maybe these natural language models don't, or like, I don't know if they will be able to do that because of that, because they may not be able to create, I don't know, these physical models in the sense that we do, that we can manipulate and I don't know,
yeah,
that are in that sense material. So I would like to know your perspective on this materiality of models or how you see them.
Very interesting that you picked this up, because that's the other part where I hope philosophers of science will start thinking about modeling differently. The background of this is that large part of the discussion has been about there is a model and there is the reality, what is kind of the relation between the two, they do they represent, to what extent, etc. You know, again, this very idealized idea of what a model is. Some people have been trying to look at this as things that you play with, and these include these very material models, such as planets, orbits, you know, and you really kind of put you do a maquette of this, but also you can extend this and say, if I have a model that is a set of equations and I intervene on a variable and I set the value of the variable in this and that sense, then I perform an intervention, a manipulation on the model. In this sense, even if it is just changing a value in, then it does count as a form of materiality, you see? So that is kind of part of what you are after. But then you ask a slightly different question. Suppose that a large language model such as ChatGPT is prompt, say, build a model for this phenomenon, you know, and then we'll come up with presumably a set of equations, I don't know, to describe something, we don't know. And then you wonder whether this counts as materiality or whether this counts as what? Because I think it does count as a materiality of the model. I don't have a problem in accepting that if a human being comes up with the model and ChatGPT does it as well, they share some of the features. For me, the interesting question comes next and say, am I going to trust this model? What is the validity of this model? What does this tell us about the human process of coming up with modeling and therefore knowledge at a later stage, etc.? And there I am a bit undecided. For one thing, it is because this has been tried already kind of in the past. There have been labs in which they tried to have an algorithm coming up with the laws of motion. Yeah. And the algorithm did, I can't remember what was the name of the algorithm, but then, sorry? Yes, that was the one. And then you think, of course, I mean, you picked the data to give to the algorithm. I mean, certainly the algorithm was designed in certain such and such way. I mean, there wasn't the same starting point for the algorithm and Bacon back in the times, you see. So I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that we are not asking the right question there, because it seems as if we keep asking whether the machine is going to replace us. You know, like, well, I mean, if they want the machine to replace us, then we build the machine in such and such a way. So what do you want to get out of the machine? For me, that is the question. What do you want to get out of the machine, out of the algorithm, out of ChatGPT, and can you achieve that, and how is this going to contribute to the broader enterprise of which you remain in the lead?
Yeah, I can tell you maybe a little bit more on how we went around those lines, because there were like half of us that were thinking like, we are still, or this is how I think, we are still benefit, or we will benefit from understanding what these algorithms do, in the sense that we need to go through this process of arriving at the thing in order to fully understand. And for me, this process of arriving is really important, but there were many of my colleagues that were telling me, yeah, but maybe it's not really needed. Maybe it's just like we will prompt it, and then this thing will give us, like, I don't know, an answer, and then we will work on it or with it in the same way that now, I don't know, we code and we don't really know the full process of how an algorithm outputs a solution. So there are these kind of two.
No, I fully get the worry, and the big worry I've had so far with large language models is that, and this is where philosophers of science have a point, is that we paid so much attention about, for instance, the quality of the data that you put in, because this is what is playing a role for the quality of the data that you get out. And now with large language model, the idea is that just put as much as you can, you know, and there is no selection of what we put in. But certainly, if you're using ChatGPT for scientific purposes, you really want to have some kind of a control on the data that you put in, and not to mention the way in which the algorithm work. So either you have to stand still and just wait to be surprised by what the algorithm will come up with. But I mean, why would you do that? I mean, we spend time in training scientists, explaining things to them, learning about data collection and data analysis. I mean, and we are still surprised by moments of serendipity where you come up with a novel idea. Clearly, we don't have control on the full process. Fair enough, you know. But I find it really misled, this idea that just because you can just put in as much data as you can, then something good will come out. But you are recording the meeting, so this will be used against me.
So I'm afraid my point will also be, or my question will also be, on the materiality.
Oh, no.
But in a different direction, I think. So it was on the on your notion on the semantic artifact you had earlier, and I'm not sure if I misunderstand what you mean by that, but I was just thinking, would you say that this depends on what kind of knowledge you might look at, in the sense of whether you look at knowledge that is really discovered, in a sense, in this natural scientific way of through experiments or looking in the world in any, like, in the broadest sense, basically, whereas when you look at knowledge, like mathematical knowledge, for example, for which at least some people would argue you don't discover, but you kind of invent or do something else, would that change your way of thinking whether this is an artifact or a semantic artifact?
You pick the very interesting example that I am deeply unsure about, that is mathematical knowledge. I mean, mathematics is a very special category in the realm of the special disciplines in philosophy of science. And sometimes it is considered as part of the philosophy of science, and then sometimes it is really something apart. There is a practice turn also in philosophy of mathematics, and that I found very interesting, and I could not delve into the details of that, but from the few conversations that I had and a few things that I was able to read, is that maybe if we look at mathematical knowledge from a practice perspective, then we may get to conclusions that are pretty close to the one that I reached here, because typically there the debate is that you either have this intuition of what these mathematical entities are, or so they exist somewhere, or we create them kind of out of scratch. But then again, in the classic way of doing philosophy of mathematics, we never discuss what is the practice of establishing the theorem, of validating this claim, etc. And I really suspect that if you look at mathematics from this practice perspective, then there will be at least one sense in which we also produce mathematical knowledge, because it may be an interaction between a human agent with, say, the external world. If you consider, for instance, geometry and how we idealize some forms of nature, plus perhaps instruments as well. I mean, if you look at logic as a form, as an instrument, and I would be pretty much inclined to say that logic can be an instrument, just like my meter to measure. And then, I think I would like to talk to these people working in the field, in the mathematical practice, because, and also how they teach mathematics. This is where I had some initial conversations with people working in mathematical education, and it looks like that we have massively underestimating parts of the materiality, because this is how we teach mathematical concepts. So that's a conversation that I would like to have.
Mm. Yeah, very Thanks. Interesting. But you're right, they go from these ontological questions to the more like scientific practice or mathematical practice.
But I think the trend that you see is the same. When I said philosophy of science looks at the outputs, that is the same for mathematics. You know, the theorem, you know, the status of an axiom, etc. But we haven't looked at how we get to establish this and that. So I think the same kind of broad characterization applies.
Thanks for this very inspiring talk. Maybe before I ask my question, just two remarks. I think what is interesting when you just said logic as an instrument, this is how Frege starts in the Begriffsschrift, right? Mm. He was in interaction with the opticians, with Abbé at Jena at the time, and so he uses a lot of optical analogies, and for him logic is really like the microscope of language, as it were. So he has this, I don't know whether you're familiar with the passages.
No, so I mean, my memories of studying Frege were when I was a student, and it was more from the philosophy of language kind of perspective. But again, I think we never studied how he got to establish the theories of science that he came up with. Yeah. And so you see, I think, again, this tells of, if you start looking at the practice and how we establish things, then we may give different emphasis. So this is a beautiful example of how we may change the perspective. So thank you, I'm learning again.
Thanks. So maybe just to register another reaction on Alexander's question, I thought, I mean, you are quoting Varela in connection with poiesis, and I had somehow a vague memory that autopoiesis is also used as a stand-in for homeostasis in some descriptions of natural processes. So that would be my first let's say a link to the concept in a more contemporary discussion.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I hadn't thought of establishing that link. Now that you say it, clearly the autopoiesis is a concept that is there. When I engaged with that part of the literature was mainly to establish the embodied part of knowledge. But then I didn't think of linking it back to the concept of poiesis itself. Yeah. So it's nice that you picked on that, because Maybe it does lend further support that there is a poetic process going on. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. So I think, Alexander, your references are much more to the point. But just to register. So to ask a question, I found it very interesting that in your book you relate a lot back to hacking, which is for me, you know, firm ground where I'm familiar as more a philosopher of science. And he makes this threefold distinction where you have sometimes new happenings in interaction with nature coming from theory, coming from experiment, but also coming from economic interests.
Yeah.
So when he describes the story of the steam engine and the development of the steam engine, it's really hardcore capitalist interests that drive the development in the end of thermodynamics. And would you make a distinction there? Or would you say technology encompasses this economic sphere as well? Or is the technology, in the sense of developing tools to interact with nature, would that be a bit separate from the economic considerations that sometimes also drive, you know, new forms of interaction with nature?
Yeah, it depends, I would say. It is possible that not every area or every episode of technoscience has the same incentives or constraints. Yeah. There is also a book that is titled History of Technoscience, but in fact it is more about modern contemporary times, trying to establish a very close link between military research and innovations. And I mean, I know that book also because a former student of mine wrote large part of his master's thesis based on this. Yeah. And I think it is frightening to just have that kind of perspective, because it looks like that kind of all of our science is just driven by this military research. And I think maybe large part, but not everything. So if you put these military kind of inputs on a par with some economic interest, certainly there are areas that are heavily driven by them. I don't think all of them will. And so for me, again, I think it is part of how we set up the question to give emphasis to one aspect or the other. I mean, some of the areas that I looked at for the book, for some, I'm pretty sure that there is no military connections. I mean, my colleagues doing e-ideas, I would put my hand on fire that they have zero connection with the military world, okay? Also the colleagues working in molecular epidemiology, unless there is something super secret going on, I don't think that there is a kind of something in the back stage. Now, you could still ask whether the framework program of the European Commission has some lobbying. But I mean, you have to go a few steps back. And clearly, at some point, there will be big stakeholders, so big that clearly escape the kind of research that I can do in a book like this. Mm. And so I don't want to be blind to this. And clearly, sociology of science has been quite right in studying also this more political and economic aspect. The point I would like to make is that there is something to be said about the role of technology that is not just this economic and military kind of incentive that we got. So I hope we have a space as epistemologists to say something valuable about this. But of course, that discussion has to happen, clearly.
Yeah.
But not all of it is dependent on this.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.